At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, rating, downloading. All new listeners, you're all very welcome. If you have been listening for a while, you're enjoying it, do let people know. We really appreciate it. Subscribe where you can. That all makes a huge difference to us, not financially, but emotionally. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be talking about science communication. And when we look at the pandemic, one of the things that we have to admit is that the communication of the science has not been great, and it has probably led to greater loss of life. Why is communicating science so tricky, and how can we do it better? We'll be speaking to Samantha Yameen, a neuroscientist, science communicator, and digital producer from Canada, about it. If you'd like to comment on the program, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science, and we get to your comments from last week at the end of the podcast. Now, it hasn't been a huge week for science. I think if you were going to publish the week of the inauguration, it's probably not the best week to try and get your story out to the wider world. But there have been some interesting stories. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lara Dungan join us now to go through them. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
No, it can't be.
What is it?
Oh, shit.
It's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Shane, has to do with a super puff planet. What's this about?
Yeah, I like how you think academics hold back science stories based on the news. They've no control over when the stuff goes out.
No, not the academics, but presumably the PR team, the outreach officer that sends out the press release that makes it to the... I mean, surely they would think, do you know what? Inauguration day is not the day I'm going to get my earthworm's new genetic... whatever, published, I would imagine.
You're actually correct, Jonathan, as always. But this is a cool story, and it's from scientists in Montreal. And they've been working on exoplanets, this group, for a long time. Previously, they discovered water on an exoplanet. We know of 4,000 exoplanets, and this story focuses on one, and it's called WASP 107b. So it's the second planet in this WASP 107 system. And they found that it's a gas giant. It's about the size of Jupiter, but very interestingly, it is 10 times lighter than Jupiter. And they say, well, this is confounding them because it's far lighter than they thought a giant gas planet could be, hence the name of a super puff planet, or a kind of a candy floss planet, if you will. So what happens in a gas planet is when they're formed, they need a rocky core that typically is about 10 times larger than the Earth. And around that, you get the gas envelope.
So there's always a rocky core at the center, I suppose, that creates the gravity to create the sphere of gas around. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd use the word create gravity, but it has a gravitational effect.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And it can hold on to the gas around it. And what they found here using some very cool techniques is that the planet's core is far, far lighter. And imagine that they're able to do that with planets that are 212 light years away from us. It's remarkable. So what they do is they look at the wobble of its host star. And the wobble of the host star tells you about the gravitational interplay between the two objects, the star and the gas giant. And so they're able to tell how heavy it is or how much gravitational force it exerts. And they concluded it's incredibly light, too light, they thought. So they're saying they're going back to the drawing board now about how planets are formed and what that might mean for our knowledge of exoplanets and, you know, where to look for life out there and etc., etc., etc. There's so much. This is a whole new area still in science.
How big are these planets? When you say, you know, about the size of Jupiter, what sort of size is that?
Well, the diameter of Jupiter, I think, is about 10 times bigger than that of the Earth. So these things are big, right? But their rocky core is small. So and that's what's unusual in this planet. So it's the same size as Jupiter, but its core, its rocky core, is significantly smaller. And that is the quirky thing that they found. That's what's new in this paper.
All right. Our second story, Lara, has to do with elephants.
Yeah, I think this is a good news story. Anyway, it's research that came out of the University of Bath. And what they've done is they have commandeered satellites that are up in space. They're about 600 kilometers off the surface of the planet. And what they've done is they have used them to take photos of approximately 5,000 square kilometers of elephant habitat in Africa. And they have then taught a machine to count the elephants. So you can see photos of these. So it basically looks like gray blob versus sort of slightly greener blob. And the gray blob is the elephant. But it's remarkable. This is 6,000 kilometers away. And these machines are able to pick out the elephants with extremely good accuracy. They're not going to get these satellites for free. They'll have to pay for access. But it's a really great way to keep track of animal species. I mean, you're not going to be able to use it for a mouse, but it can span international borders, which means that you don't have any of the complexities that go with that. You can also stop having to use aircraft. It means there's less people on the ground, so less danger. And also it's really good in terms of anti-poaching because it's up to date on the minute information. So it's not the first time AI has been used. Stirling University has used camera traps and AI technology to identify the animals that are there. And it means that you can look at these pictures and identify them within days rather than, you know, when humans are looking, it could be months or years. But overall, it's still a little bit sad. I mean, back in 1930, so 90 odd years ago, there were around 10 million wild African elephants, and there's less than 500,000 today. So it's sad overall, but if we can use these types of up-to-date, immediate technology to stop poaching, to protect the elephants, then we could see those numbers rise quite a lot over the next decade or two.
I know they did something similar with, was it penguins, where they mapped out large areas of penguin poo and they could see where they were thronging and they could make estimations guessed on this. But this is actually allowing them to identify individual elephants on a screen.
Yeah,
using that technique of machine learning, essentially saying, this is an elephant, this is a cup, this is an elephant, this is a tree, this is an elephant. And after a while, the machine gets it. Do you think that there's a danger here if that information is made public, that poachers will use it to find the elephants? That has happened before with other game.
Of course, it's absolutely a danger. I think the important thing is definitely going to be security here. Like I said, the universities obviously don't own these satellites and they do have to rent the time on them. And it's really important, I think, that the people who do possess this kind of technology make sure that it's not used for nefarious purposes, as it were. But you're right, it's a risk. And I really hope that doesn't happen.
Our third story, Shane, has to do with the sort of mystery that butterflies have presented in the way they fly.
Yeah, absolutely. They have huge wings relative to their body size. And that has confounded scientists when they wonder how they're able to take flight.
Look rather unwieldy when you think about it, this tiny little abdomen, thorax and head. And they're, you know, really, really tiny little things. And then these enormous wings, sometimes, you know, they've got to be, 50 times its body size. And they're expected to flap that.
Yeah, and of course, we all think of butterfly wings and that really story about butterfly wings causing hurricanes. You know, that one from the example of chaos theory. So that's not true at all, of course. So this work is from Lund in Sweden, and they found that butterflies are really effective at the way they're able to fly. And what they did was they put a lot of slow motion cameras in front of butterflies, and they made models of them and put them into wind tunnels to understand their mechanism. And they found that what happens is when a butterfly wing beats, so when the wings kind of close together and open apart, they don't just kind of snap shut. What happens is that the leading edge and the back edge come together first before the middle. So this forms some sort of like cupping action. you know. And that makes a little pocket of air. It holds a little pocket of air in between the two wings. And that provides for a more efficient and a better form of thrust. So it lifts the body so that the whole thing is able to take off in a more efficient way and with more power. And it's very, very subtle when you think of it. And so, they, as I said, they did this using incredible cameras, and I'd love to see their models. They didn't have pictures of them, unfortunately, in their paper. But really, really clever models where they varied different things and made different constructions of wings until they got it just right. And
it sounds like a great lockdown project, doesn't it? Let's try a bigger wing with a little thing at the back. It's like, you know, your children trying paper airplanes and teaching them about aerodynamics. Shane, thanks very much. Our final story, Lara, has to do with moody teenagers.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about this one. The research that has been done in terms of the contagion of mood, or how infectious a mood can be, has always said that good moods are more contagious than bad, and that people who are in a bad mood tend to withdraw themselves from society. And that's sort of what has been believed up until now. But there's new research that's just come out of Oxford and Birmingham University, where they essentially took a captive audience. Now, this is before COVID. They took 79 children on two different live classical music performance tours that were residential. So these children were living in. And what they got them to do was every day they got them to grade 12 different types of moods. So, you know, how sad they are on 1 to 5, how happy they are 1 to 5. And then also their interactions. So who did you spend most time with? Were you 100% of your time with Kimberly or 15% with Sam? And they looked then to see about how mood was contagious. And what they found was that all moods were contagious. But they found that bad moods were more contagious than good. And also, if you handed off your bad mood, as it were, it made you yourself feel slightly less negative afterwards, which I suppose is maybe good. But they also found there was no evidence that those in a low mood withdrew in any way. So they had the same amount of social interaction. Now, look, it was done in a residential setting. It's hard to know if people can really withdraw. But the slightly sad news is that bad moods are more contagious than good, apparently.
I think we knew this intuitively. Like, you know, when people ask you, how are you doing? You know, I think it's the default is I'm doing fine. And even when your life is being sucked from your body, you say, yeah, I'm good, because you don't want to spread that mood. And certainly it's something we really put our finger on in our household recently. It's when one of us walks out the door of the bedroom, and usually it's my 9-year-old, he walks out kicking the can, you know, looking down at the ground, we've got a tough morning ahead. It's 3 hours. It infects everybody. Yeah. And it, you know, with lockdown, I totally get it. But it's something for people to think about, and a takeaway that you may have already just realized, but actually your bad mood or the bad mood of your child will slowly infect everyone in that household.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so
absolutely.
So letting that go on, or not addressing that, not fixing that, has repercussions for the rest of your day. That's what we found. It's not rocket
dead
science,
right?
But
well, maybe you shouldn't have cans in like lying around your house.
That's true. Well, we sleep on the streets, Shane. So
well, you know what, Shane? Jonathan just created gravity a little while ago, so the can is hardly the biggest issue today.
All right, Dr. Lara Dungan, Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks very much. Okay, on the way, how to communicate science in a pandemic. Yes, welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, something that I don't talk about a huge amount on this program is the fact that I'm very passionate about science communication, and I train scientists on how to communicate, and I have a whole company that does that. But it's something that we really need to talk about now, because if we look outside the window and see what's happening, one could say it's a total failure of science communication. And in this world of disinformation and fear and mistrust of experts, the job of science communicators to get across the key ideas that will keep us safe in a pandemic, but also a guide society to a better future when it comes to things like climate change or fracking, has never been more important. And so we're delighted to be joined by Dr. Samantha Yameen. She's a neuroscientist and science communicator. She goes by Science Sam on Twitter and Instagram. She's a huge following as a science communicator. She joins us from Canada to talk about this role of the science communicator and why it's so important. Sam, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
This is it's something that I suppose if you're a science communicator, it's everybody talks about science communication, but outside of our world, most people don't talk about don't really know what science communication is. So maybe we might just explain what that is.
To me, yeah, it's a term that when I tell people that's my role, they're like, okay, what do you do? To me, broadly, science communication is speaking about science in conversation with anyone, whether it's between two scientists, whether it's between someone who's never really studied science and someone who has, in any direction, it's the communication of science. What it really comes down to in practice, though, is having conversations, not just telling speeches about the process of science, explaining the why behind the headlines. And this can happen in the print media, it can happen in podcasts, in books, and it can happen, you know, in the back of an Uber. It could happen anywhere.
Yeah, and I suppose there used to be a way that scientists communicated with the public. Often in the beginning, it was in rooms or theatres with a lot of old men. Well, young at the time, but now we think of them as old men. And that obviously over time has hugely changed, not only in the diversity of people communicating science, but the sort of people who communicate science. That there are many scientists who communicate, but you don't need to be a scientist to be a science communicator.
Absolutely not. I think you have to be someone passionate about telling stories about science, but I don't think that there should be gatekeeping necessarily in any formal way for who can talk about science. Because in fact, to me, the goal of science communication is to empower everyone to participate in conversations about science so they can use that science to make decisions and to think about our world. So it should be by everyone and for everyone. But that's not to say that there aren't best practices, but there shouldn't be gatekeeping as to who can engage in those practices.
The reason I got in touch with you is because of your talk about science communication messaging around viruses and vaccines. And this article you wrote made me think that the public sort of needs to think about this as well, about not only the sort of information they should be following, the people they should be trusting, but also what makes good science and how we might reach those audiences if we have good information. So let's talk a little bit about the total failure of science communication that is the current pandemic we're in. If we had an entire audience glued to the screen, if we had a single message, which for the most part is stay at home, wear a mask. If we had a common purpose, which is to save lives and open the economies, how on earth did science communication fail so badly across the world?
Oh, just a simple question. Honestly, I think it's a part because science itself, and especially in the context of a pandemic, has so many layers. Yes, there's the science and the data, but then there's also the policy, there's the notion of public health, there's how it intersects with the economy and social determinants of health. And I think it's at those intersections where we're really failing. The message of just stay home, for example, is incredibly impractical and in fact not helpful at all, and it alienates people who can't just stay home, and it doesn't tell you anything about the why. And the why is what motivates our behaviors, and this is an incredibly difficult behavior that we've had to do for almost a year now. So it really lacks the depth that's required for the complicated world we live in. And I think it's those intersecting things, combining the science and then in a practical way, translating that to policy and inspiring behavioral change, that is where we've failed. And I think people now are seeing these messages in press conferences and they're like, oh, but the scientists keep saying this, but it's not working. And it's like, well, no, you know, a politician is saying this that's hopefully based on the science, but it's also being impacted by other factors. And so people are just kind of confused what message has to do with what dimension. And instead, I think we need a much more multi-dimensional conversation about the science.
I think one of the biggest mistakes was that there was a lot of science to communicate, and it seems globally very few professional science communicators were consulted on how that science should be communicated. Like, you know, and I know that that science is tricky. It's it can be reversed, it can change, and that of course using analogies might not be useful because they don't paint the full picture. Do you think that the fact that science communicators weren't a big part of the messaging across the world is maybe a part of it.
Absolutely. I think this is, I mean, there are many lessons to be learned here in this pandemic. But one of them, especially for the science world, is there should be some baseline level of science communication training and engagement in the course of a scientist's career. The fact that I don't even know how, I couldn't even tell you, the majority of my life I have spent in school studying science, all throughout my PhD, and yet I never had to take a single course about how to talk about my findings, even though they're publicly funded. It's through publicly funded research. I think that's a big failure. It should, no, we don't need every scientist to be an expert in communication, but we need them to at least understand that they need to give some context when they're publishing preprints, non-peer-reviewed work online that have huge implications. You know, I think that failure, the fact that communication isn't a regular part of the science machine, is a huge, huge issue. And then the fact that a lot of it was communicated without, forget just consulting people with expertise in science, but people with expertise in human behavior. Why weren't sociologists and a behavioral psychologist also helping to craft those messages? Of course, we can't have everyone involved, but I think it's just, again, the lack of respect for how multidimensional everything is, I think has bit us a little bit.
And the speed of everything has been difficult to deal with, you know, preparing these messages and thinking about them as well as you know, doing the science is tricky. In this country, there is an act of defamation, and it's basically you can say something that lowers that person's reputation in the eyes of other reasonable people. That's pretty much the legal definition. And one of the defenses of that in this country is if you're publishing quickly for the public good. In other words, if you're giving the public information as quickly as possible, if you accidentally defame someone during that, it's a defense. And I think that's an interesting sort of nod to the fact that when everything's coming hard and fast, you can't be perfect. And I think that is probably one of the reasons why the communication of the science and medicine hasn't been great. The other thing is that there's been a lot of sharing of disinformation. And I know this is something you were tweeting about. How do people who at home, when they consider that they may be getting their science news, not just from the New York Times or Ottawa Weekly or the Irish Independent, that they might also be getting their news from the Twitter feed of their yoga instructor, and actually these influencers, these people in people's lives, actually are also news sources for many people. That's a problem, right?
I don't know. Social media is a double-edged sword. There's no gatekeeping into who can have a voice, which means that you can have a much better diversity and much better representation in who can communicate, in this case, about science, than you did before, when there was a lot of, again, gatekeeping as to who could speak about science. But it's the double-edged sword is that it also means anyone can build a platform. But there's a bit of a paradox in what I do. I mean, I'm telling people to be wary of their sources, and yet I'm expecting them to trust me as a source. And I'm just one person. So I think I totally acknowledge that conflict. I think the key thing, though, is that we need to have a little bit more training and discussion about how you determine a trustworthy source. I actually don't mind that people go to individuals. I think it can be incredibly helpful to find someone who speaks like you, who looks like you, who shares your social values. I think that can make things a lot easier to navigate if you find the person who's most similar to you but has a little more knowledge. That can be really helpful. But I think there are some general rules. Like, are they willing to discuss with you? Are they willing to clarify if you misunderstand? Are they defensive if some of their peers try to say something they said is wrong or give a critique? Are they open to voicing corrections? It's so easy to make a mistake, as you said, especially with the speed. But there's a difference between the people who will double down on a mistake and those who will readily be like, oh, I made a mistake. Here's what I said. It should have said. Here's a great learning moment. And I think those are some really important flags to look out for. Do a little test, ask someone or question something someone says in a respectful way and see how they respond. And you'll quickly see if there's someone who's very insecure or someone who's open and willing for dialogue.
Yeah, I think that's a good rule of thumb. I think scientists, at least the ones I speak to, are very wary of the media and social media in particular. And as someone who has so many followers across different social platforms, I'm wondering, what would you say to scientists who feel that social media is destroying science, that it's getting rid of any of the nuances, and that it's not a good place for people interested in the good of science to be operating?
I would say I profoundly disagree with that statement. Social media is making science way more accessible, familiar, entertaining than it's ever been. And it's giving it appeal to far more groups of people, people who live in remote communities, or people who, like me, are the first scientist in their family or the first science enthusiast in the family. It's opening up a lot of doors. Also, as someone who's a first timer in science in my family, I didn't have anyone to go to in my direct network for advice on how to navigate studying science and the challenges that come with that. So I could go online and build communities, which was incredibly impactful. So I wouldn't say that social media ruins science in any way. And I get why scientists are afraid of it in many ways, but there is also a lot of good. And I think we just have to be advocates for our institutions to support us getting some training or to support us in communicating these difficult things. And we should also be advocates for the platforms, for example, letting you report false information. That's a new feature. A lot of them have just introduced somewhat recently, but we should be advocates for these types of responsible features on these platforms and sharing with others, helping parents teach their kids how to use social media responsibly. We should be advocates for those things too.
When you look at the media in any country, when it comes to particularly this COVID situation, you see that it's not just scientists from virology, pandemics, from disease transmission, epigenetics. Epidemiology. We see a lot of scientists that are not from these fields speaking up publicly and using their position as scientists to, add a bit of weight to their argument. What do you mm-hmm. think about that?
I'll use myself as an example here because I'm trained as a neuroscientist. I have expertise in molecular genetics and cell biology, so you could argue it's close enough for me to understand some elements of the pandemic. But I very specifically try to make it clear that when I'm speaking on shows like this, for example, or even online sharing information, it's as a science communicator. It's not, I don't want to be introduced as Sam, the science expert. No, I'm an expert in communicating that science.
Yeah.
I'm not giving my own opinions. I'm summarizing for you the opinions of those who I trust who are experts in their field. I don't know that that's always an easy task to make clear what the source of your information is, but I think it's really key. If you see someone who, and it's hard to tell who the subject matter expert is sometimes, but it is worth if you're getting information, especially about new things, if someone's giving you breaking news and they're not a science journalist, I think, and if they're telling you some really new piece of information, it is worth digging. What is their actual job? What is their job title? What were the last five papers they published? Does it look like it's in a somewhat similar field? And I think you can get a sense of that even if you don't understand the full paper. But yeah. I think that's a pretty key thing. If they're trying to tell you new information, do they have the real ability to give that new information?
Yeah, and you can tell a scientist is giving you good information sometimes by the fact that they're not saying this is 100% the truth.
Exactly.
Most good scientists will say, look, this is what we know right now. We're not sure about this bit, but this looks pretty good. This is what we've seen in some of these studies, but you know, most scientists completely qualify what they say. If anyone's 100% sure about something, that's when I start to go, wait a second here.
Exactly. It should be annoying because they keep giving caveats every second. that's I think a good scientist in my books.
There are a lot of scientists who also fear this dramatization of science and the work of a scientist. And certainly when we look at science communication pointed towards young people, festivals and events that are filled with explosions and bright colors, there is, for me, a slight concern that a children will believe that that is what happens in the lab. And maybe this is, you know, age appropriate material, but the life of a scientist is very rarely exploding things, making gunge or making bubbles and stuff. And I'm just wondering, do you think some science communication actually harms the reputation and the idea of what science is?
I think the explosions are a good conversation starter. I think they're a good start for a lot of people. If it gets people excited about learning, I'm not going to knock it. I think that's great. But I do agree that maybe the proportion of time the amount of airtime we give to explosions is a little much. I think
dialed back the explosions a little.
Again, if it gets people excited, and it gets me excited, I'm like, wow, how'd they do that? So I think it's great. But at the same time, I think there's also a lot of quieter, smaller things that are worth being excited about. I mean, look at the pandemic. This is caused by something way smaller than the human eye or even some of our best microscopes can see. You have to get the really, really good expensive microscopes to be able to see. So to me, that's my favorite kind of science. It's the kind that is invisible yet is a part of us. And I think that getting people to appreciate that gives another layer of appreciation to the complexity and beauty of our world. And so the explosions are cool, but sometimes sitting back and closing your eyes and feeling your blood and thinking what's in that, feeling your heart pump, can also be really fascinating. And that's where people can really start to see, hey, things are really more complicated beneath the surface. Maybe I can't always grasp something and there's still something to learn about it. And I think those have really big lessons that will make people question anything that is too simplified when they see it. There is that ripple effect. If we make everything, oh, it's always obvious, it's science, it explodes, people might assume it is simple when it's not. Even the simplest thing like skin has many layers to it and many cells and many things inside those.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. And now that you say it, you know, those sort of science communication interactions, when my kids are there, they do start asking questions about how that works and they start their own exploratory journey. But I think you're right. I think maybe the percentage of time that we spend doing that sort of stuff is maybe a little off. What do you think the biggest challenge is from a science communication point of view when it comes to the vaccine? Because we're only just rolling this out now in Canada. I'm not sure what sort of vaccination hesitancy you have, but certainly over in Ireland we've a small amount of it, but it does exist and it is problematic. What do you think the biggest science communications challenge is when it comes to the vaccine?
There are two key things that I think about a lot. I think one, it's keeping in context for people that the very anti-vaccine people, the people who will spread disinformation about the vaccine and will be evangelical trying to get you to not take the vaccine, that's a very loud minority. Even in the most polarized of places, like my neighbors down in the U.S., it is a large population, but it's still the loud minority. And that's important because hesitancy begets hesitancy. If we start to normalize that hesitancy too much, then people start having doubts where they didn't before and where they can't even really give a reason for that doubt. So I think it's important to keep the context that it's allowed minority who are really against it. With that said, those asking questions, those who are more hesitant, you're very valid and very right to ask questions, and that's part of science. So I encourage people to ask those questions, but just to seek the answers from those who really are invested in giving you access to the truth and not trying to persuade you one way or another. I'm not trying to get you to take the vaccine. I'm trying to give you the information so you can make the best decision for you. The second big thing is that people who are a little bit more hesitant or do have more doubts, it's usually rooted in something beyond the facts and figures. It's usually rooted in feelings of alienation, whether it's due to financial hardship or economic hardship, mistrust of government, which often can be for very valid reasons. And so I think as communicators and as anyone who's If you're enthusiastic about the vaccine, that's amazing. I ask you, please, please do get it then if you're already sold on it. But also do what you can to have productive conversations with those in your life. And remember that they might be coming from a place of past trauma or bad experiences. And so include that in how you talk about it. Mm. Acknowledge their fears and make it about more than the science, because it is.
Yeah. I've always had a problem with people who have sort of labeled flat earthers or anti-vaxxers or
yep.
build a wall type folks as stupid, because, you know, I believe we're all, our lives are very much determined by our genes and our environment, right? And so I think if I was born in the same place, if I was exposed to the same news and the same ideas, I would feel the same way as this person. And so people who are concerns about the vaccine probably comes from the information world that they're inhabiting and the people that they trust, and maybe a story that came that maybe was or wasn't true, but influenced them and their thinking. And so I think the polarization of these voices is really damaging. We do see voices in the Irish Twitter sphere where there's this belittling of people for believing certain things. I think it's not helpful.
Well, I also will say, though, that these people who are really passionate speaking against the vaccine, they have spent a lot of time. Like, I don't want to discredit or patronize the amount of effort they have put in into building their case. And so I don't always fault them, because I think they're just being preyed upon by people who are, there are the people who are intentionally spreading lies and falsifying statistics and information.
Or giving poor context or a not full picture, and, yeah.
And there are people starting that, being sneaky on purpose. And I fault and I have something to say to those people separately offline. But then there are the people genuinely trying to learn and spending so much time and effort who it looks sound. It is convincing. I don't blame them. And they're being misguided, and I don't fault those people. And in fact, I respect the amount of time they've put into this decision. I'm just sad that there are so many people trying to mislead them. And that's really the issue there. So these people are intelligent. They are doing a lot of research, as they call it. It's just they're finding the sources that fit a narrative that speaks to something beyond the science. It's speaking to some other feelings that they have, and that's twisting what they trust, and that's where the issue is to me.
Something that may never go away is that slight distrust a small percentage might have with an expert, and that is, I suppose, one of the saddest things to have happened in the socio-political sphere over the last number of years. Samantha Yameen, a neuroscientist, science communicator, and digital producer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
If you're interested in science communication, I'm doing a conference in March. It's called SciComm. You'll hear a bit more about it over the next while, but the website's scicom.ie, where we're bringing together all of Europe's science communicators to talk about how we communicate science to the outside world. scicom.ie. It's time to look back at some of your texts and tweets from last week. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins us from his day one out of isolation. How are you? You're like a butterfly.
Yes, I'm very excited. You people underestimate the excitement of just seeing and perhaps interacting at a safe distance, of course, with other human beings.
Yeah, I haven't done
it. It seems all very new and interesting to me now.
I my wife went out and she went shopping and bought some hand sanitizer in the pharmacy today, and she was like, it was so good. And she went shopping for like essential food items. And now Dara won't mind me saying that was a very novel experience for her. She might as well have been like, you know, diving a shipwreck. It is not something she does a lot of. So it was all, everything was new and exciting about that. So it was good to hear you out of the isolation. You're back in the living world. What is it like out there? I haven't been out of my 5K. I haven't been out of my 500 meters in a while.
Yeah, well, it's perhaps unsurprisingly very empty. Mm-hmm. I walked in and I live in the city centre, so it's a walk to work. I walked through a lot of streets that would usually be very busy, and there was no kind of conglomeration of people except for at a Garda checkpoint where there was a few cars. And that was about it. Like, I think I passed from in and around the Liberties to our office, which is just on Diggs Lane, just off St. Stephen's Green. I maybe passed 5 people max.
Wow.
Yeah.
So no crack quiet. At all. Is it like, when is the crack? When is the crack going to happen? Like, it's just...
Well, you know what's bad? Well, I mean, I was about to say, you know what's bad about it? Most things. But one thing that's also bad about it.
Bad about it? Fucking everything. Yeah. Everything is what's
one extremely, bad. One extremely minor thing that's bad about it is, I don't think we're not going to get that moment of like, the crack is back, because it'll be so incremental.
Yeah.
You know, it'll just be like, it'll get marginally better at a very slow rate, to the point that I don't even know if we'll get to, like, human nature. I don't think we'll really appreciate that it's fully better. We might just go back into our normal routine of like, oh, everything's crap, even when it was great.
Reminds me of like when I was very young, the very slow incrementals that you would get in a relationship you were in with someone. It felt like very long, hard yards to get the shift. Do you know what I mean? It feels like it's going to be like that. It's going to be, you know, couples, you know, like if you're going out dating at once, at what stage do you go, all right, let's break that 2 meter? I don't know.
Well, if we're going to take that shift analogy, I'm afraid I don't think it would even be like that, because at the end of that incremental journey, you still have the excitement of, as you said, getting the shift, but there will be no get the shift moment. You know what I mean?
Well, there'll be, I'm in a pub with my mates and we're enjoying something, or there'll be, I'm getting on a plane and I'm going somewhere sunny, like that sort of stuff I'm dying for.
Yeah, that will be great.
Right. People don't need to hear us having the same conversation that everybody's having all over the world. It's not very interesting. So let's move into some of your comments from last week. We were talking about turning slime into drugs. We spoke to Paul Jensen, who is a marine biologist, and he was telling us about the Nautilus, this awesome ship that sails around, and it's got all of these fantastic instruments. It live streams, and they've got a little robot that goes down and navigates the bottom of the ocean. You can see some really cool stuff. Someone says, the story about the Nautilus begs the question, why do we spend so much time and money going to the moon when we know so little about our oceans? Can't we do both? I mean, I feel this question was already asked, or someone asked a very similar flavor of this last week, and I said, let's just spend all the money that kills things on that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's a constant trope. It's always like, why are we wasting money on space when we, you know, when we could be saving people on Earth? We could do both.
we could do both. It's just that the only thing is you have to not give money to the people who kill other people. How do you think that's going to work? We were speaking to Dr. Stuart Farman about how to live life better according to science. And one of the things he was talking about is this idea that we need to drink 8 glasses of water, 2 liters of water every single day. And it's not the case. We don't need to be swigging Evian bottles everywhere we go, is what I said, even though I gave Evian, Aiden, as you remember, a bit of a shout out for free. I didn't get any free Evian.
Not yet.
And yeah, exactly. I'll just turn out an enormous mountain of plastic.
Got to seal the deal.
Max says, please, Jonathan, not plastic bottles of water, tap water or rainwater. Indeed. Always thinking sustainable. Thanks, Mac. Another says, do you have to put the slow cooker on the boil first, then turn it down? Huh? Do you have any recollection what that's about? Do you have to put the slow cooker on the boil first, then turn it down? I have no idea. I'm going to say yes. Another person says, I drink water when I'm thirsty and easily have 2 liters per day. Am I drinking too much? I think if you drink water when you're thirsty, that's what Stuart was saying. Your body knows when you're thirsty because you feel thirsty. Now, some people, I'm sure, don't feel thirsty because of some brain defect, which does happen, right? You're hitting the brain. Some things, weird things happen. Maybe if you get in the brain in a certain place, you don't feel thirsty. But almost all of us feel thirsty. When we're thirsty, we drink. Right, Aidan? Are you a big
water drinker? That's not complicated.
No, it's not. I mean, it's not. It's just, people just, you know, people. I think people need rules to live by. You know, they go and they think like by having this rule, they can live just a little bit better than their neighbor. That's what I believe is at the crux of all of this.
Well, maybe everyone the confusion
wants to
is
a little bit healthier.
Maybe the confusion is like you do have the. If you took that principle to eating. You know, how often do you feel like having like nachos and cheese dip? I mean, depending on your psychology, particularly at the moment, that could be all of the time. And maybe you shouldn't eat the nacho and cheese dip all of the time.
Well, yeah, my body takes a very long time to tell me, you're done there, pal. Like, yeah, as I tweeted 2 days ago, you actually can eat too many jelly babies. We were talking about urine and how we could possibly use recycled urine for heat. And Tom in Longford says, hi, Jonathan, I use urine on my compost heap. Is that for the same reason? Do you use your own urine, Tom, or do you gather the urine of your cows in some sort of rainwater harvest device? Please let us know. We were talking about anthropology and how another person had figured out that actually we didn't come out of Africa, or it isn't 200,000 years, it's 300,000 years, or there was actually two different types of humans, not three or whatever it was. And I was my usually dismissive self talking about anthropology and saying they're all bitchy about each other, aren't they? They're always, you know, saying, no, that's not right. This is right. Brian in Dublin said, I know you like to slag off anthropology, but surely the ability to admit errors and constantly correcting and updating the science is a strength, not a weakness. Brian, you're sort of missing the point. It's not like they're updating their own science. They're slagging each other off. They keep on trashing each other, which I know what you're saying. In the end, science wins, Aidan, but they are still, it's still like slagging each other off. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think. Is he right?
I
think he's kind of right. Like it is good. It is good of science, or a good principle of science, that you admit when you're wrong, or you're open to being told you're wrong. And paleontologists are maybe very open to being told they're wrong, but they also seem extremely open to telling other people that they're wrong.
Yeah, they do. It seems like the difference between anthropology and every other science is every other science, they say, well, we think this is actually something different. We've discovered something new and we believe it goes against what we learned. And then anthropologists say, we think we've discovered something different, something new, and it goes against what we previously learned. And they spit on the person, and it seems like that is the difference between anthropology. It's essentially the same, but with a bit of spite.
In defense of them, though, in fairness, what they're trying to find out, you're dealing with very kind of scant evidence that's kind of isolated from the other bits of evidence, and it involves, or necessarily involves, I guess, a little bit of extrapolation. I mean, I'm reading a book at the moment about from a paleological anthropological point of view, and I found it's been brilliantly consistent, and it's kind of
it's out of date appreciation. By now, you know that, right? If it's in print, it's already out of date. There's already someone who's written a book or a tweet saying
it actually might be, because I think it might have been one of our news items recently that we mentioned Neanderthals, and the book is about Neanderthals, and it said something like, oh, this actually turns out like it was a cave painting. It was this the cave painting story a couple of weeks ago. And it was like, this puts a bit of a doubt in our mind as to whether Neanderthals had made cave paintings. And I happen to be reading the cave painting chapter in the book at the same time. But
it's sure an evolving science, but all the time, very quickly and rather nastily, it seems. Aidan McKelvey, thanks very much for joining us. Thank you for listening. And thanks to the team, Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, Garrett Mulhall, Steve Daunt and Stephen McLean. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. More Future Proof proper on Saturday. In the meantime, stay curious.